Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war at the moment is being fought in the courts, in Washington political circles, and indeed across the land, in the context of a very, very difficult and unpleasant fight over President Trump's executive order restricting, at least temporarily, immigration from some countries. And to talk about that and more broadly, what's at stake, I'm thrilled to have with us one of the people who I've come to admire most in Washington. Speaking of intelligence, she brings a lot of it to bear every day in her work as the Director of Government Relations at a truly indispensable organization, Numbers USA. She has worked in Washington in a number of different capacities, including for the highly esteemed Center for Immigration Studies, and is coming to us from the thick of the fight, where she always is when it involves matters of national security and particularly immigration-related issues. She is the great Rosemary Jenks. Rosemary, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. Well, let me ask you first and foremost to just do sort of a level setting on what this executive order is, what it does, and as importantly, what it doesn't do.
It's actually a very simple order, very straightforward. It requires the secretaries of DHS and state, plus the Director of National Intelligence, to figure out within 30 days what information is actually needed to thoroughly vet a foreign national who wants to come to the United States, to ensure that we don't have terrorists coming in. They then have to come up with a list of countries that don't currently provide that specific information and tell them they have to provide it. And then we reset the vetting process. In the meantime, the order says that we're going to pause the entry of all nationals from the seven countries that were designated by Congress and President Obama as presenting a significant terrorist risk. We're going to pause that immigration for 90 days. Then, in addition, we will pause the entire refugee program for 120 days and Syrian refugee resettlement in particular until the president determines otherwise. So it's essentially at a maximum a four-month pause in the refugee program and a three-month pause in immigration from the essentially either failed or terrorist sponsoring states. What it does not do is ban Muslims, or in fact, ban anything, because it's a temporary pause.
When we hear that endlessly repeated, that it is a Muslim ban, usually people say, well, even if it isn't exactly, that's what Trump wanted to do. That's what he said he was going to do in the campaign. Do you credit such comments?
Well, look, if the president in fact intended this order to ban Muslims, he's wildly failed. I mean, this affects probably 12 to 13% of Muslims worldwide. It does not include countries like Egypt, Indonesia, all of these Muslim-majority countries that are not included, not affected in any way by this ban. And so, you know, if he was trying to do that, it's a wildly unsuccessful attempt. So, you know, I think we need to look at the actual words of the order and recognize that he did what he intended to do, which is pause entry from the most dangerous countries, the countries that, you know, these are failed states to a large degree, where we can't get information on the people who want to come to the United States. How do you vet someone if you don't know anything about them?
That's really the core of this, isn't it, Rosemary Jenks? You've spent many, many years working on and trying to improve and where necessary to suspend the kinds of immigration that involves defective vetting. Talk a little bit about how that process works now, Rosemary. How adequate or inadequate do you think it is?
Well, if you look specifically at the refugee program, which we have all been told for years now is the most thorough vetting system we have for foreigners in the entire world. Well, what actually happens with refugees is that, first of all, the United Nations selects the refugees that are referred for resettlement in the United States. So they get the first crack at this. They pick out the people that they send to the U.S. processing system, and they interview those refugees and then decide, okay, that one should go to the United States and this one should go somewhere else. Once that happens, the refugee contractors, generally the same contractors who are paid by the head to bring those refugees to the United States, they get to interview the applicants next. It's only after that happens that a Department of Homeland Security employee interviews these applicants. So by the time our government actually has a face-to-face interview with the refugee applicant, two other organizations that have a vested interest in sending those refugees to the United States have already interviewed them and potentially coached them on what to say to convince the U.S. government employee that this is a true refugee and should be resettled in the United States. So, you know, during all of this process, the contractors themselves actually run people through the databases. They have full access to the databases that most of the databases, not classified ones, that we process these folks through to see if they might be listed somewhere. Now, if you're a terrorist and you're applying for a refugee visa, basically the only database that we might find you in is the Department of Defense database that has fingerprints from IEDs. So, and that is in fact how two Iraqis in Bowling Green, Kentucky were found. They had already been admitted to the United States and their fingerprints were found in Iraq on IEDs that were used against our troops.
These were guys, as I recall, who were translators for us in the past and therefore given this kind of special preferential treatment to come in. Is that right?
Yes. They were exactly like the Iraqi detained at JFK Airport the first weekend after this order was put in place.
Rosemary, let me ask you quickly, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk about, and I hope you'll come back to us very, very soon to discuss this further. But I heard you describe last week the attitude of at least one federal employee who would have gotten to the contractor's approved people in this process you've just described, and that individual's attitude at least. And I'd be interested in both your telling us about that story, but also whether you think it's kind of representative of the mindset of those who are supposedly doing this very rigorous vetting of individuals to come into this country from problematic places.
Well, there's no question that there is a revolving door between the United Nations, immigration lawyers groups, the refugee resettlement contractors, and the State Department in terms of who is actually processing the refugees, who's interviewing them. And so, you know, the government official who gets the third crack may very well be have worked for the UN or one of the resettlement contractors. So, I mean, there is a very sort of nepotistic relationship between all these folks who all have a vested financial interest in this program. And so there is no awareness of fraud detection, of national security issues. You know, this program is set up to be about moving people into the United States.
Yeah. And I think you were saying that was actually explicitly sort of communicated by one of the officials who's involved in this process. Rosemary, we are just hard out of time, but very quickly, is there any question in your mind as a Harvard Law School trained lawyer that the president is acting within his constitutional authority and necessarily so?
He is absolutely within his authority. There is no question of that, despite what this judge in Seattle said. He has constitutional authority as the president of the United States over national security issues and over foreign policy. That's the starting place. The second thing is the Constitution very clearly gives Congress authority over immigration, and Congress has put into immigration law a provision that specifically allows the president to deny entry to any alien or class of aliens he believes their entry does not serve the public interest. Yeah.
This is the crux of the matter. We hope this will be reflected in the rulings today, perhaps as soon as today, from the Ninth Circuit and ultimately the Supreme Court. Rosemary, I know you'll be following it closely. I hope you'll come back and report to us very soon. Thank you so much for your time today. Peter Husey joins us next. We'll talk nuclear deterrence and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are delighted to have in the house, virtually at least, Peter Husey. He's a man of many parts. Among other things, he is an instructor at the Naval Academy, these days teaching a course on Congress and its role in national security policymaking. He is also the president of Geostrategic Analysis and one of the country's really duty experts on nuclear forces, deterrence, programs, budgets, and related issues. And always a delight to have him here. Peter, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank, very much. I appreciate it.
Well, President Trump has, to my delight, and I'm assuming yours as well, made some early and very forceful commitments to rebuilding our long-neglected nuclear deterrent forces. Peter, give us, if you could quickly, an overview as to their current condition and why such an upgrade is so urgently needed.
Okay, thank you, Frank. So your listeners understand, we have modernized our nuclear deterrent twice. One was in the Kennedy administration between 61 and 66, and you have to give credit to the Eisenhower people because they began both Polaris and Minuteman under the great work of General Schriever. But the bending metal and getting things done was late 50s, let's say early 60s. And then we did it again under Ronald Reagan between 81 and 86 primarily. And we are now 40 years as opposed to 20 years between modernization efforts. So we basically took a holiday for 20 years. So we're in a situation where the Minuteman was last modernized or put in the hole in 1970. The Trident submarine is now almost 30 years old and needs to be replaced. And the B-2 bomber, we only built 20 of them. That was in the 1990s, and the B-52 is going to be 70 years old when
That's
we bring on the new B-21. Yes.
Yeah, it really is. Our guest is Peter Husey. We're talking about nuclear deterrence and what it takes to maintain it. You were describing I think it's fair to say, obsolescing forces we currently are fielding, Peter. What needs to be done to improve both the delivery platforms and what they deliver?
Right. Clark Murdoch, who founded the Program on Nuclear Initiatives over at CSIS in Washington, had a wonderful phrase. He says, we're in danger of rusting to obsolescence. And we have to rebuild Minuteman, which is going to start with a contract award, final award in 2018 and 2020, put the first missile out in the field in 2028. The first submarine is going to be built in 2027-28, and the newest bomber probably 2026. On the other hand, Russia will have completed its entire modernization by 2022, China sometime in the mid-decade. So while they're running around, sprinting around the track and about halfway through the race, we're trying to put our sneakers on. What we need is all three elements, platforms to be redone, which is now planned. It is in our DT&E. We're doing some bending of metal, buying the reactors for the submarines and so forth. Now, the warheads, we're going to go from 12 varieties to 5. That's a multi-billion dollar effort every year. We're going to have one warhead for subs, one for ICBMs, one for bombers, and one that will go both ICBMs and SLBMs, and then another bomber weapon. So we're going to go down to a limited number, but we had to do a service life extension on these things, which means basically they're so old they had to be refurbished. So we've got that to do now.
Peter, could I just ask you on this? Because this is a highly technical question, of course, and I'm not equipped to get into much detail with you, and we don't have time to. But there is an issue, it seems to me, that when you're dealing with extraordinarily complex pieces of equipment like modern nuclear weapons, particularly our thermonuclear weapons, that you can't just sort of start messing around with them, overhauling this bit, sticking in a new piece because the stuff you have to take out doesn't meet OSHA requirements or otherwise. Are you confident, Peter, knowing all that you do about this, that we can just be tinkering or even massively refurbishing these weapons without actually testing that they work when they're fully assembled?
Well, the top people in this business, the number one guy is Johnny Foster, who's in his 90s, who actually has built nuclear weapons. He's one of the few still around. He believes that the sub-testing and the computer work will let us know if we have a problem. But there's a footnote to that and a caveat and an asterisk, which means for now. I am not opposed to the idea of testing. The problem is once you put that on the table, all you know what will break out. But let me give you a you asked for costs. We're spending $25 billion a year on everything. Warheads, the three platforms, subs, bombers, ICBMs.
Out of a total budget of how much?
$618 billion in the Defense Department, $4.1 trillion in the department, in the U.S. government, and what's never talked about, $6.2 trillion in all governments in the United States, and I'm taking into account transfers. Now, everybody complains we're going to go from 25 to 35 billion, maybe 36, 37 billion in 10 years. That's the peak. Well, the defense budget by that time, if Mr. Trump has his way, which I hope he does, will be about, or Senator McCain, for example, will be close to 800 billion. The federal government will be spending 6.6 trillion, and all government in the United States will be spending 8.5 trillion. I know those are big numbers, but when you look at the proportion of the defense budget, the federal budget, and all government in the United States, nuclear weapons modernization will actually fall as a percent of those numbers, even though we're modernizing.
And Peter, let me just say something I know you believe very strongly, as do I, that there are those who say, well, why would we spend all that money, even if it's a relatively small portion of the larger pie, on weapons that we'll never use? The truth of the matter is we use them every day to deter terrible things. Let me ask you, Peter, though, before we run out of time, there are some parts of this modernization that are almost always overlooked, and I'd like you to just speak to them, too, if you would. The infrastructure, the weapons complex, as it's called, has been allowed to atrophy. Talk about rust into obsolescence. It's rusted through in places, as you know, some of these facilities dating from World War II, for crying out loud, Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
Talk about that and the people piece of this. Do we have people coming into the complex who actually have the requisite skill sets to maintain and modernize the forces as we need them to do?
That's an excellent question. A certain portion of the labs, the nuclear labs, and the National Nuclear Security Administration facilities have been beginning to be modernized. A lot have not. So you're right. There's some areas where you look at and say, oh my God, we got a problem. But that's because we went on a holiday and didn't do this for 20, 25 years. As to the people, if you give them a mission, they'll not only be trained and come in, but they'll stay. That's a very critical component, and that mission should be, we are rebuilding the nuclear enterprise from A to Z, and yes, we have never had to launch these things, we've never had to use them since World War II and in Japan, but we use them in a way to maintain deterrence and stop major wars between the nuclear superpowers have never occurred. And if you look at the number of people that had died between 1914 and 1945, it came up to basically 3% of the population per year. After the end of World War II to today, the number is not 2%, not 1%, not 0.1%, but 0.02% of the population of the world. And so what you've seen is war went into terrorism, wars of national liberation, that kind of thing, but you don't have the all-out total war that you had in World War II.
Right. It's a real return on investment of the most important kind. Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I wanted to talk to you about missile defense, what a robust state-of-the-art one would look like. We'll get you back to do that soon. Thank you very much for your time today, my friend. keep up the great work you do at the Naval Academy and at Geostrategic Analysis. We'll talk with you soon. We'll talk with Patrick Poole next about some of the jihadist threats and the phony countering violent extremism program. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of the country's preeminent experts on the counterterrorism problem, is the way we've long thought of it. I think of it more of as a counter-jihad problem. He is Patrick Poole, an investigative reporter as well as counterterrorism expert. You can find his extraordinary writings at pjmedia.com. And it's a pleasure to be able to welcome him back to our microphones to talk a bit about some of his recent musings and revelations concerning a program that the Obama administration called Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. That and the contribution it's made to the fine mess I think we're in at the moment. Patrick Poole, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank.
So, you have been writing of late about this program, Patrick, and just to give our audience, which I think probably has some appreciation of all of this, a point of calibration, remind us what CVE was, how it came to be part of our lexicon, and more to the point, the focus of efforts to counter those who are trying to kill us.
Well, Frank, back when Obama first came into office in 2009, they immediately began to reorient the counterterrorism training programs and began to introduce this countering extremism terminology. But it really got took hold in late 2010 and in 2011, where at the demands of Islamic groups saying that this counterterrorism training was Islamophobic and biased, the Obama administration directly from the White House instituted this new countering violent extremism program. Now, if you go to any of the CVE experts and ask them, you know, what exactly is countering violent extremism, you could get any number of answers. It was completely undefined. It's basically whatever the administration wanted and imposed on all the various agencies.
And to the extent that this body of experts, as you say, is countering violent extremism experts, was populated by people who seemingly had ties to one of the sources of violent extremism, not necessarily the only one, but I think the most important in our time, at least, namely Sharia supremacism, for want of a better word. Did that not contribute to a kind of, well, willful blindness, is how Ted Cruz and Scott Perry and others on Capitol Hill have been describing it? Is that your view as well, Patrick?
Absolutely. And the Islamic groups like the Islamic Society of North America, Council on American Islamic Relations, the other usual suspects that the Justice Department had even named in federal court as supporters of terrorism ended up being brought in by the Obama administration to help them advise on these policies, on purging the counterterrorism training of this supposedly biased material. Ironically, it ended up being these very groups who helped establish these policies. And you had individuals like Mohammed Majid, Mohammed Elibiari, Omar Alamari, who were on these DHS task force to establish CVE, were the very people who've turned against it. So, you know, they built up this program that now they're attacking for targeting Muslims. So, you know, it's some of us would argue that that's a feature, not a bug, of CVE, is that this exactly was the plan all along, that these groups intentionally blinded the government agencies responsible for national security and counterterrorism, and then attacked the very means by which they did it. You know, to blame the U.S. government, it's a bizarre situation, and it's very appropriate, as Reuters reported here last week, that the Trump administration, one of their first things they began looking at with the landing teams, even before the inauguration, was ending the CVE disaster.
Mm. So, Patrick, let me just put this into perspective, if I can. On the one hand, we had Muslim activists, if not actually Muslim Brotherhood operatives, and I have the feeling that they're both, but you had people like that inside the wire of the United States government, actively involved in changing the lexicon, purging the trainers, purging the training materials, with a view to getting us to focus on violent extremism in the first instance, which meant you sort of gave a pass to the whole stealthy kind of jihad, the civilization jihad, as the brothers call it, that is, in some ways, I think, more dangerous in a society like ours. And then secondly, they turned against the whole program, I guess because they wanted us to focus exclusively on people like, oh, I don't know, conservatives and constitutionalists and returning veterans and gun owners and the like as the real source of these violent extremist threats. Is that basically what we've been dealing with here?
I think so, Frank. And we saw it initially with some of the Homeland Security reports under Janet Napolitano, where they were targeting the American Legion and some really bizarre attempts to gin up a threat from, you know, returning veterans, and which, as soon as they were exposed, the Department of Homeland Security had to withdraw these reports. And they were relying on organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center that, you know, who raise money, I mean, millions of dollars, trying to gin up this threat that really doesn't even remotely compare to what we're seeing with the global jihadist threat.
Don't look at those jihadists, folks. Look over there. There's a bigger problem over there. Trust me. Look over there. Patrick Poole, one of the things that I know you've been very closely following, of course, is in addition to, as you mentioned, the efforts of the Trump administration to revisit what's being done under this rubric. But they've also been trying, as you know, to keep more jihadists of either the violent kind or, I would hope, the stealthy sort out of the United States, stop importing them, in other words. We talked earlier in the program about this with Rosemary Jenks, but I'd like to get your view, particularly at the prospect that we have federal courts, and it may all go all the way up to the Supreme Court, according to Andy McCarthy, and come out badly, that the president will be stripped of his constitutional authority to stop such importing of hostile forces. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's certainly strange, given the case law, that federal judges say that the president can't take these actions when in fact, nothing was ever done when Obama and his predecessors took these actions. You know, and I'm thinking specifically about Obama banning for 6 months Iraqi refugees after the two Iraqi refugees were found in Bowling Green, Kentucky, who were had been directly involved with the al-Qaeda insurgency in Iraq and killing American soldiers. And the courts took no action then. You know, these organizations and activists, so-called activist groups that that are out marching right now, they were nowhere to be seen. And you've seen some of the media that have said, well, you know, it wasn't reported at that time, so it was, you know, it was okay that we didn't get excited about it because it was done very quietly. Well, I mean, isn't that the media's job? Is to highlight that if that's in fact a problem.
Harder and harder to figure out what the media's job is these days, Patrick Poole. Hey, listen, we've got about 45 seconds. Just very quickly, Patrick, one of the other things that the Trump administration is said to be looking at is designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, as a real expert in this subject, Patrick. And you've spent a lot of time studying both here and in Egypt, among other places, the Brotherhood. Do you think that's an appropriate thing for them to do, and indeed a necessary step?
Well, absolutely. And as you know, Frank, I've been one of the loudest voices saying we needed to do that based on I was just in Egypt here in late October and meeting with government officials about how deeply tied the Muslim Brotherhood is with groups like Hassan and Liwa Athira that are directly involved in committing terrorist acts all over Egypt.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think the stealth piece of what they do here is a precursor to violence as well. Patrick, that's a subject for more discussion in the near future, I hope. Thank you very much for the great work you do at PJ Media. Patrick Poole, come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Ken Timmerman. We'll talk about Iran and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is the inimitable Kenneth Timmerman, a man who was actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. To my way of thinking, deserved it a lot more than Barack Obama did. But he has been contributing mightily in a variety of different capacities for many years to our understanding of various challenges and threats we're facing in our country and around the world, notably from Iran. He is an investigative reporter par excellence. He is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. And he is a multiple-time best-selling author, including Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi, and Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video, Hillary and Obama Blame for Benghazi. Ken Timmerman, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
I wanted to start, I think, by asking you about Iran. There has been a decided ratcheting up of tensions with that country since Barack Obama left office. I wonder if you think that's both warranted and necessary, and if so, what you think in particular the National Security Advisor to the President, Michael Flynn, meant when he said, "We're putting Iran on notice."
Well, Frank, first of all, the ratcheting up of tensions is because of the Iranians. It was the Iranians who attacked the Saudi naval vessel. It's the Iranians who've been installing C-802 missiles off the coast of Yemen. It's been the Iranians who've been threatening U.S. military forces throughout the Middle East and threatening the United States with missile strikes should we do something that they don't like. So if there is greater tension today, it is because the Iranians have stepped up the tension. Now, what did General Flynn mean, putting Iran on notice? I think he meant exactly those words, uncertainty. He's not going to telegraph what his actions are. The president has made that clear as well. He's not going to tell them ahead of time what he is going to do. He's going to prepare a coordinated series of policies to put pressure on Iran, including potentially helping dissidents inside Iran, either materially or diplomatically.
This is, of course, something that you have been championing for decades, I believe, Ken Timmerman, and you were very much in favor, I believe, of a policy that Barack Obama publicly and repeatedly eschewed, namely supporting the Green Revolution in its day in Iran. Is there, in fact, an opposition there to work with? And if so, can we help them in material ways without simply getting them all killed by the Islamist regime there?
Well, the short answer is yes. And we see that. We see it on social media. We see it every time there is a confrontation between the United States and Iran. We see people actually taking to the streets. I was shocked, really, a couple of weeks ago to see a group of pro-Shah supporters who I thought were long gone at Persepolis. There's all flavors of opposition in Iran, but it's not organized per se. It is a popular discontent. And I think that's what you see. There is not an opposition movement that is organized with a leader, with the headquarters and the rest. If there were, they would all be in jail anyway. It is a popular discontent which could become something greater with a little bit of help from the friend.
What kind of help are you thinking of, Ken? Again, you've given this a lot of thought. You do have contacts inside the country. How can we best, if we want to put into the mix, and I think you're right that the administration is certainly giving that consideration, a popular dissent enhancement program, for want of a better term?
Well, Frank, first of all, we can step up our Persian language broadcasting, which has been languishing in recent years. It is so pathetic at Voice of America. Some people think of it as the voice of the Ayatollah. So we can actually return the radios, the television, Radio for Europe that we have in Prague that broadcasts into Iran, into true surrogate broadcasting units, especially the one from Prague. And that's very important. It gives people inside Iran moral support. It makes them understand that America is there with them. That's an important thing. There's a fine line between inciting people to do things that you can't back up and empowering them. And I think our goal has to be to empower the Iranian people to organize and to oppose this murderous regime.
Ken, let me switch gears with you. There is a concerted effort underway, as you know, and as you've been writing about, among other places at The Hill, I believe, on the part of Democrats to do, it seems, anything and everything possible to destroy or at least undermine the Trump presidency. You've described it, I think, as declaring war on Trump. Talk a little bit about what's going on here. What are the manifestations of this agenda and its implications?
Well, I was pretty shocked listening to some of the floor speeches the past couple of days. Senator Ben Cardin from my state of Maryland is calling Trump a demagogue, a hate monger. I mean, these are words that are way beyond the pale of opposition discourse, especially from the well of the Senate. I think Democrats are making a huge miscalculation. They clearly failed to understand the mood in the country in the election. They failed to understand that part of their base, blue-collar workers, industrial workers who've been losing their jobs, disadvantaged by globalization, had gone over to Donald Trump. And they are facing in 2018 with the midterm elections, where there are far more Democrat senators up for re-election, 10 of them in states that Donald Trump won. They are facing a defeat of historic proportions. And I think, frankly, they're just freaking out. They don't know what to do. And so they've declared Trump war on Trump in every possible way they can obstruct his presidency. They will do so.
Yeah. And the implications of that, of course, are going to be very, very bad for the country. In the meantime, it may conduce to further reinforcing of the majorities of the Republicans in Congress. I think that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing if they're the right sorts of representatives and senators. But I do think that there is going to be a very tough ride for America in the meantime if at every turn the opposition party is seeking not simply to use the democratic process to advance its agenda, but to destroy, as I say, the president and his. Ken, let me ask you about one specific example of which direction the Democrats are headed, and that is the selection of a new chairman for the Democratic National Committee. You, of course, are very familiar with Tom Perez from your days in political life in Maryland. He is apparently the front runner for the Hillary Clinton camp. And then there's Keith Ellison, representative from Minnesota, who is apparently the darling of the harder left, the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing. Talk about these two individuals and what it suggests about the state of the Democratic Party that they are apparently the front runners for this job.
You're right. Hard left and harder left. You know, I can remember Tom Perez when he was, I believe, he was a state senator in Maryland and working with Casa de Maryland. He was an advocate for illegal immigration in Maryland before he was at the Labor Department. And, of course, Keith Ellison.
And the Justice Department
Muslim.
Before that in the Civil Rights Division.
Exactly.
Making mayhem there.
Yes. And then Keith Ellison, obviously a Muslim member of Congress, who has been doing his very best to promote the bringing in to America of refugees from Muslim countries and favoring Muslim immigrants. You know, I've spent a lot of time in Iraq and in Jordan trying to help interpreters for U.S. forces, Christians who were working in Iraq to help our guys on the ground. And they were systematically defavorized by the State Department and by the UN. They were not selected for refugee resettlement. Instead, both the State Department and the UN would put Muslims at the head of the line.
Yeah. This is a point that we were talking about earlier in the program with Rosemary Jenks. We're out of time for the moment, Ken, but I do hope you'll come back to talk about this a bit more, because I think both Tom Perez and his background and Keith Ellison and his affinity, if not direct connection to the Muslim Brotherhood, require very careful scrutiny, and we propose to give it to them here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Do come back to us, Ken. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.